On the morning of September the 3rd, 1939, a telephone was picked up in Whitehall and one word was spoken into it. 2 days previously, the Minister of Transport had taken control of the railways, and on receipt of that word, British Railways switched over from a peace basis to a highly complicated wartime footing. We can give only a glimpse of their efforts, a glimpse of the traffic, the labours, the difficulties that helped to form the pattern of the wartime life of Junction X.
Railways entered the war at the peak of their efficiency. During the years before the war, they spent over £450 million on new works and improvements, a gigantic program resolutely carried through in the face of acute world depression in trade. Bigger and better engines were designed, locomotive depots were modernized and supplied with the most modern equipment. Turntables that work themselves, giant coaling plants that fill an engine tender in a few minutes.
The evacuation of British children is going on smoothly and efficiently. The Ministry of Health says that great progress has been made with the first part of the government's arrangements. Railways, the road transport organizations, the local authorities and teachers, the voluntary workers, and not least, the householders in the reception areas are all playing their parts splendidly.
My name is Fred Franklin, and my dad's name actually was Fred Franklin the same, so I was always called Young Fred. Yeah, he worked on the railway from the 30s, really. He worked all through the Second World War, and of course they were exempt from going in if they didn't want... Now, some of them did, because they went in the Royal Transport Corps, and they actually, some of them went abroad, you know, and drove some of the engines abroad, like the austerities that they sent abroad. But obviously, like the miners, they needed them in this country to keep the transport system going. Armaments and moving troops was always a priority. The other was done when you got the chance. And of course, if the railway was bombed anywhere, I mean, that was going to hold the job up completely. But these trains and engines are already on the way, so that they could be anywhere where they stopped. So they just have to keep a fire in them to keep them warm, and then they'll be there perhaps for days, as long as they can manage on the water. The water was the main criteria, really. I remember he said to me that the blackout was always a nuisance because they had to black the engines out. And you can imagine, with a hot fire and having all this camouflage all on the engine, it made it very difficult. And also in the summer, extremely hot because it was containing the heat. Of course, they only had to do that at night, but they had to put, every time, you know, it got dusk, they got to put these sheets up because you imagine the fires from the sky would light up, you know, so it'd give them a good target, wouldn't it, really?
The blackout, with its retarding effect on operations, was the railway's ever-present enemy. Whitewash, liberally used, helped passengers and the staff to carry on. The whole system of railway lighting, in stations and depots, on signals and trains, had to be altered to meet the blackout regulations. After dark, screens prevented glare from the engine footplate, and from darkened stations, the trains ran through the dark countryside.
We'd run a train, a late night train, passenger train up to Richmond, and we're coming back empty. The lights had been left on in the carriages. They shouldn't have been. They should have been switched out, but they hadn't. And we got about as far as Catterick Bridge, and we got stopped at this signal cabin, and we got the message ARP purple. We had the blackout sheets, which we rolled down into position in order to mask the light from the firebox. Further down the line, we got stopped at another signal box, ARP red. That meant red is overhead. We weren't at all happy about having the lights on in the carriage. We knew we would be able to be seen, and we were. The first thing I realised was there was fires, more fires burning at either side of the rail tracks. Now, they were incendiary bombs that had been dropped, obviously, at us. We'd been targeted. Now, that made us feel very uneasy, see. We knew we'd been seen, we knew we'd been targeted, and there was a strong possibility that we'd be attacked again. And as I say, we weren't happy at all. We felt like sitting ducks. But fortunately for us, he also spotted another passenger train on the North Allerton branch further to the south, and he decided to have a go at it. Now, in this instance, he used his cannon, which was mounted hand-operated in the nose of the aircraft, and he wrecked the train with cannon fire. Fortunately, it was an empty train, but for one passenger who was a railway guard on his way back to his depot on the cushions, as we described it, and he was killed. They killed him. In the meantime, that gave us breathing time to make a run for home, and we got a more or less a trouble-free run to home, and we thought we got away with it. We were actually passing under the canopy at Darlington, and he caught up with us. He was back, and this time he opened up with his cannon. Again, fortunately for us, at the other side, Banktop Station in those days was a power station with high chimneys and cooling towers. The pilot, coming in very low for a cannon attack, suddenly spotted, and he had to bank away sharply to the right to avoid flying into the chimneys. The result was that the poor old gunner, as he opened up, instead of hitting his target, he raked the cooling towers in the power station. And it was a Heinkel 111, a Heinkel 111. We never saw it, but the men in the sheds at the other side of the main line, they had a clear view as he bunked away overhead, and they were able to identify him as a Heinkel 111. In retrospect, we did have a very lucky escape in two ways. First, we were lucky that he attacked the other train, chose to attack the other train. And second, had he caught us, had he caught up with us a minute earlier on the main line, it could have been a different ending altogether.
I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
This is Tuesday, May the 21st, 1940. It is almost certain that within the next few days, the British Expeditionary Force will be evacuated from France. The BEF is at this moment facing the biggest disaster in the history of the British Army. It will be a total evacuation. We're not planning an immediate return to the continent.
For days and nights, ships of all kinds have plied to and fro across the Channel under the fierce onslaught of the enemy's bombers, utterly regardless of the perils, to bring out as many as possible of the trapped BEF. There was every kind of ship that I saw coming in this morning, and every one of them was crammed full of tired, battle-stained and blood-stained British soldiers.
Entraining is essential. For all we know, hell might break loose over those ports.
What about stores, their equipment?
I think that you need not concern yourself with freight. We will consider ourselves fortunate to hand you over men. Your passengers will not be ordinary passengers. They will be exhausted, many of them wounded. They will be soldiers who have passed out of hell.
On the station, I watched the men climbing into the long waiting trains. It was astounding to walk along carriage after carriage full of soldiers and to find in each one silence, for most of the men were fast asleep where they sat. All the way along the line, the people of England stood at the level crossings and in the back gardens to wait.
That movement started at dawn on May the 27th, and they never stopped for 9.5 days. 323,000 men they took away from the forts, and I saw drivers and firemen on trains coming into this station who were dazed with weariness. I'll never forget them. Dirty, exhausted. A ghost army in a ghost train.
My name's Mike Callis. I can remember as a lad, it would be after the Dunkirk evacuation, in my village at Great Bowden in Leicestershire, we had some very large sidings just to the north of the village. And immediately after the evacuation, we had the hospital trains there with a lot of the wounded fellows. They were ordinary coaches that had been gutted out, and they had double berths of beds on either side, you see, and then there would be areas set aside for drugs and things like that. I can remember, you know, the nurses and some of the orderlies that used to be on them. And we kids from the village school, one of our regular things which we used to enjoy, I say with that with, I was a little bit guilty about it, but we used to go up to these hospital trains to visit the wounded fellows in the trains. And we used to sing to them, and of course they had chocolate, and as kids then at the beginning of the war, chocolate was something we rather enjoyed getting. The railway was at that time a means of moving vast numbers of people in a fairly comfortable manner, because you've got to remember we hadn't motorways in those days, and to bring people up from Dover and the south coast to safe areas in the Midlands would have been a very arduous journey for badly injured fellows. Some of the fellows were in very poor shape, very much like when you see them coming back in the aircraft to line them nowadays.
He did say one time when he went to London, to Willesden, he was taking a train, a coal train, and this bomb dropped on the bridge as they were going through. Fortunately, the bridge, actually part of the bridge, fell onto the tender. It didn't actually hit the cab, but of course it fetched the engine off the rails, and he was there for quite a while they dug all that out and sorted it all out. That's the only experience he ever told me about. But he, all through the war, obviously, it was all... They all worked extremely long hours. Yeah. So it wasn't a very pleasant time for Rowan at that time. And of course, Coventry was blitzed terribly. I mean, my mum and my father, they actually lost their house in Charter Avenue that was bombed. We lost our home. We had to move to go and live with my grandma because the armament factories were in Coventry. And obviously they got intelligence and they were trying to get hold of them, weren't they?
My name is Jim Naismith. I was born in 1925 and served in the Cameron Highlanders in Italy for 3 years. The only interest I had in the early days was my uncle, who was a driver from Crewe, and I always remember the knocker-up coming and tapping on the window to get him up in the mornings at about 3 o'clock, which also woke me. I was about 3/4 of a mile from the railway. You could hear it all the time, shunting in the goods yards, and trains going through. The main thing I remember was the raids on Coventry, where the Coventry station and Coventry goods yard were demolished. And fortunately, they were soon restored to normal, and the trains were running again quite happily. I was at home with my parents in Earlston in Coventry about 7 o'clock in the evening on November the 14th, 1940. The sirens went and we didn't take much notice of it. And then later the flares started dropping around the city. Bombs started, and then we decided it was safer to go under the stairs and sit it out. Unfortunately, my sister was ill and I had to keep going out and getting poultices to put on her ear. Hope it didn't turn into meningitis. The thing I remember mostly was one bomb came down and blew the windows in, and I was just gone outside to get the boiling compress, and the gas went out, and that was the last hot compress we could put on my sister's ear. I think we went under about 8 o'clock, and about midnight we emerged, and I went up into to see whether my aunt was all right about half a mile away, and then we got back and the second wave came over.
I want to remind you about how very important it is that all water shall be boiled before being used in Coventry. No matter where you get that water from, whether it's out of a tap or anywhere else, will you please see that it is boiled before it is used?
They were after the marshalling yards, and they were also after the many motor manufacturers that were at that time in Coventry. Tanks and armoured cars and all that kind of thing, and at, just by the cemetery, they built the Whitley bombers. But the main thing I remember was the glow over the city where the cathedral and other places were burning. You could feel it, you could smell it.
That grand old parish church, bomb after bomb, incendiary bomb, fell. And we fought them with what we could, of equipment we had, one after the other. It took a long time. And then, finally, a group of three fell on the roof, and well, the fire blazed up, and we had no more sand and no more water, and practically no more strength to go on. And the fire got a big hold. The fire got a complete grip of the roof and burnt from roof to roof, and all the pews blazed up. That great inferno inside.
It is history, yes, and for us old folks, it's something we never forget. And I suppose never forgive. In the main part of the city, it was just bricks and rubble all over the place. Just dereliction. Factories burnt out. The cathedral was still on fire in the following day, and it was just complete devastation. I think we were just so blooming angry that we said, well, what are we going to do? So with that, I joined up.
I'm Cyril Roberts. I started in January 1942. They said, there's a job going at Woodlesford. There were so many people of my age all being called up. That was the reason somebody at Woodlesford had got called into the army. and I went to Woodlands when I was there a year. The amount of traffic going from that station as compared with in the 1930s, there was just no comparison. It would have become a very, very busy station. Everything that we seemed to handle with was all connected with the war. You had to go for a medical tour to Manchester. That was a bit of a story because you were given the time, I think you had to be there about 9:30 in the morning. There was a building, certain building, gave us the address of this building. So we went to this building that wasn't there. It had been blown up overnight, bombed. It was just a smoking coming up out of the road. So we had to all go back to the station and decided they could give us this medical in a carriage which they put in the side in the platform, you know.
This is the BBC Home and Forces programme. Here's the news. This is Wilfred Pickles reading it. This morning's news of Japan's aggression is of successful countermeasures against the invasion of Malaya. There have also been reports of enemy attacks on Thailand and Hong Kong. President Roosevelt has spoken of serious damage and casualties in the earlier Japanese air raids on America's Pacific naval bases, and the Japanese are reported to have lost an aircraft carrier and some of their bombers and submarines.
I think it was the winter of 1943. It was quite a bad winter, and there was a very, very deep snow which was lasted quite a while, and the coal to burn in the office at the station had run out. Quite often the coal train would stop, so that you could get a bit more coal on the engine to get cracking again, you know. And this train stopped, this coal train, one day, just outside the booking office, and I went out. I said to the driver, "Is there any chance of a bit of coal?" I told him what was going on. Oh, typical Yorkshire like that, and I was as much coil as I want, lad. And he went, told his fireman to go on the tender, and he threw a piece of coal out, which was nearly as big as the station itself, and it was beautiful, shiny stuff. And we carried it into the, the porter carried it into the booking office, and we had a fire roaring up. And it says, any time, so we looked out for him, and all the time he kept us in coal. There were never any more shortage of coal at the station.
In their fight against the ferocious bombing of the Luftwaffe, railwaymen and women showed that they lacked neither courage nor fortitude. Even when danger was overhead, the vital work of running the trains had to go on. Ton upon ton of high explosives and firebombs rained down on Britain during the daylight blitz period, but railwaymen and women stuck to their posts and got the trains through. Buildings were razed to the ground by landmines, incendiaries by the thousands set fire to property. But a train couldn't dodge a plane or a bomb. It just had to stop or keep on. And keep on they did.
Junction X calling. An alert has just sounded. Any travellers wishing to take shelter should proceed to the public shelters outside the entrance opposite platform 1.
I was off duty on the particular night this raid started. Suddenly, I noticed that a siding about 3/4 of a mile away was on fire. Only that afternoon, I'd placed a lot of ammunition in the wagon's stirrup, so I knew prompt action would have to be taken. We returned to the siding, which were on fire, and started the job of separating the wagons that were already alight from those that hadn't yet caught. Bombs dropped on either side of us, making large craters only 20 to 30 yards away.
I can remember, I think I would be about 10, I had an aunt who lived at Blandford in Dorset, and her husband was in the RAF out in somewhere in the Middle East. And we went down to visit them. We went from Market Harbour to London and across London in a bus to Waterloo. And we got to Waterloo, it must have been middle of the morning, and I don't think we got a train until quite late in the afternoon. And I do very vividly remember being in this queue of people that stretched all the way down the side of Waterloo Station under the bridge at the bottom. And we just sat there inching forward because the trains, you know, they went when they went, so to speak.
The thing that was always drummed into you was, is your journey really necessary? And if it wasn't, you didn't travel. But if you did have to travel, you never knew what train you'd get, even if you would get the train, because the track could be up or engines damaged. And remember, the engines were being run 24 hours a day and they were really being run into the ground. Of course, you never knew quite where you were because there were never any signposts on stations. You were always guessing where you were. I suppose people who had to travel regularly knew each of the stations, but otherwise you didn't know where you were. People always came down to cheer the troops off. You had these stalls with the Church Army and the Salvation Army. When you were on troop trains, they were always around with tea and biscuits. Believe you me, they were very welcome in those days. You never got out of the train. It was always handed through the windows to you, how many were in the compartment, and you always got a cup of tea and a biscuit. And then you had to hand your mugs back before the train pulled out of the station. We were at war, we had to carry on and do the best we could. By golly, we were going to win, and we did.
A special train notice used to come out every week from head office and told us what trains were coming through at certain times. And particularly the troop trains were coming up from Scotland, around Glasgow or Gorick or whatever, they're all disembarking. And there used to be a lot of these troop trains coming through. And you'd have a train come in with probably 10 to 12 coaches on in them days. And the signalman, he knew when these troop trains were coming, and he'd purposely put it at danger to red when it shouldn't have done, because there was nothing in the section before. And he used to tell us when he used to ring, because we had a phone in the office from the box, so-and-so was coming, and of course we used to nip across the crossing and be on the platform when this train came in. And there'd be all yanks looking out of the, where are we, boy? And what was stuff? Oh, we don't know. And I used to say, well, have you any cigarettes? It was from my father, of course. And yes, oh yes, and used to get in the pockets and giving us packets of these Camels and all these other American type cigarettes. So I used to come home loaded up with cigarettes and get my father in cigarettes, but I don't think he'd have bought any. They were very generous, I must admit.
D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress. Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
This is the day, and this is the hour. The whole sky is bright, the sea is a glittering mass of silver, with all these craft of every kind moving across it, and the great battleships in the background blazing away at the shore.
For 40 years, I've been dealing with railway traffic of all kinds, but I cannot remember dealing with such a volume as we've had to shift this year. Day and night, 7 days a week, we didn't know when D-Day was coming. And when the day did come, and we heard that our boys were back in France, we knew that we've helped to get them there fully equipped for the job.
Deeds of heroism by railway men and women were legion. Over 200 were decorated by the King for gallantry in air raids. Some 282 were killed, and over 1,500 injured. The courage of these people in the midst of bombing was matched by the speed with which the engineers repaired broken and debris-littered tracks and quickly enabled services to be resumed. Emergency breakdown trains and stocks of rails and other permanent way materials were located at strategic points. The railway system of Britain withstood the worst that Germany could do. Even the most concentrated attacks failed to interfere seriously with traffic. The organization for repair was such that delays were reduced to a minimum, and the internal lines of communication, so vital to the United Nations war effort, were kept open.
The railway then, it was a calling. It's not a job where you go in a nice clean locomotive cab and moan if there's a draft, you know. It was a calling for people, and there was a terrific pride in it. And I mean, I was very proud when I was given an apprenticeship on the railway, and I've still got the letter to prove it, starting at 31 shillings a week.
I started at 21 shillings a week.
Oh, and sixpence.
And sixpence.
Advance, Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!